Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
The truth now, more than ever, will set us free. Free to reason and think, free to take control of our future, free to hope and dream with a sense that it may all come true. The Wildside News is the mainstream alternative, broadcasting live around the world and on the archives 24/7. In a moment, we find out about gender benders and the scientists who study them here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Welcome back. You know, we've all heard about going out on a bender. It usually means heading out, filling ourselves with far too much alcohol, acting crazy and hoping we will rise up and never do that again. Well, today we look at gender benders, which in their own way share some common features with a bender. And to help us get a grip on the gender bender concept is Assistant Professor of Animal Studies at Amherst College in Massachusetts, Dr. Ethan Klotfelter. Dr. Klotfelter, we share a passion of studying animal behavior. So let's start out by first talking about what the science of ethology is all about.
Sure. Ethology is really focused with trying to understand how animal behavior evolved and how animals behave in a natural environment.
And of course, there's some legendary examples of that. For example, Jane Goodall, who is an ethologist and studies
sure.
animal behaviors, and
sure.
it's an interesting concept. People sort of watch animals. Tell us a little bit about how you go about watching animals and learning from them.
Well, you have to make sure that the animals that you're watching are not sort of being interfered or being affected by your presence, and so that's people who've seen things about Jane Goodall certainly know how she habituated herself to the animals, and then you really have to just spend a lot of time being very patient and watching the full range of their behaviors and find out what's normal and what's unusual and take lots of notes. In the old days, it used to be done exclusively with a pen and paper, and increasingly now people are carrying their Palm Pilots and their laptops out in the field with them, but essentially it's just doing lots of very patient observations.
And ethology typically has been sort of an observatory science, one where we kind of look and learn, and ethologists get together and talk about these interesting behaviors. But it really, until now, and some of your research, which we're going to talk about in just a moment, really hasn't been a predictive science, has it?
Well, it has become more experimental in the second half of this century. It started off being as you say, almost completely observational, but certainly while still trying to retain the naturalistic aspect of it, the more and more ethologists are trying to do experiments, trying to sort of understand better the behavior by doing subtle kinds of manipulations. And so we are getting a slightly better handle on trying to predict either the outcomes of certain kinds of behavior or why certain kinds of behaviors might have evolved in the first place.
Well, of course, this is where we now get into the concept of gender benders. And recently, you were published in the Journal of Animal Behavior, where you summarized your research about what appears to be a worldwide increase in unusual animal behaviors like hyperactive fish, stupid frogs, fearless mice, seagulls that can't stand up. Sounds kind of funny, but what's really going on here?
Well, there are these huge array of chemicals that are collectively called endocrine disruptors, although they're commonly known as gender benders because of reasons that hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about. But they get into an animal's bloodstream, and they essentially act like or interfere with hormones that occur naturally. And so you talked earlier about alcohol and how that might affect behavior, but these chemicals just become integrated into the bloodstream, and so they essentially confuse the body into thinking that either something should happen or shouldn't happen, and so you get, as you say, this very large list of kind of bizarre behaviors as a result.
Well, I think, you know, prior to this has been worked on for a while here, but prior to this, it was sort of a series of anomalous descriptions of descriptions of anomalous behaviors that might seem sort of unusual, but actually by the extent of this, and of course you get to go to conferences and talk with people, you've actually suggested that this is an indication of some dramatic changes on a planetary level.
Certainly, I think that these kinds of changes in behavior are certainly going to be a warning sign that these chemicals are out there. We already know that chemicals are out there, but certainly a warning sign that these chemicals are having effects on animals, and that what we know from studying behavior is that certain kinds of behaviors are really key to being able to successfully attract a mate or successfully have offspring, and so the population is totally dependent upon these behaviors sort of functioning normally. And so what we're seeing now is that these may be the indicators of population declines or population crashes in the future.
You know, all of us are fascinated by some of those behaviors which become so complex. And when we look at particularly birds, for example, or elk, or just about almost any species, including ourselves, we have these unusual behaviors that communicate, mm-hmm. Communicate fear, danger, aggression, communicate where food is. Look at the dances of the bees and things
right.
of that nature. And certainly when it comes to mating behaviors, birds are phenomenal in terms of the complexity
right.
of their behaviors. And I think what you're suggesting is that if these behaviors that are so critical for survival, if a bird, for example, if it's important that a bird call to let a male bird calls to let females know that he's available and this is the time or whatever else, that if, for example, those calls are diminished for some reason, that could dramatically affect that animal and that species' survival.
Right. Certainly, there's evidence that, again, you have some sort of complex courtship sequence that if you take a key component of that sequence out, that that the recipient or the female or whoever is trying to respond to this sequence is not going to respond or is not going to respond as strongly because it's not what she was expecting to see or expecting to hear. And so, yes, our concern is that these very elaborate kinds of rituals could be interrupted and that could have significant consequences.
Talk about some of the unusual behaviors that we are witnessing around the planet.
Well, we in our paper we sort of tried to categorize them in sort of a few general categories, and I'll just tell you a couple of examples from a couple of the different categories. Some of them are very basic kinds of behavioral impairments, like animals' ability to coordinate their movements. So we see some cases of some seabirds, like seagulls and herons, that just can't stand upright or have trouble coordinating all their limbs, and so they sort of walk and fly with very strange, sort of jerky movements. We see changes in the way in which animals respond to some intruders. So there's a lot of work done with fish and mice, and if you put in some intruding fish or mice, the way in which they respond to that has been affected by these chemicals. We already talked about courtship. The way in which animals care for their young, both in terms of building nests and in terms of feeding the babies and things like this, all of these kinds of behaviors have been shown to be affected by a huge range of chemicals.
Research process actually can be quite elegant. I think an easily understandable one is the concept of fish in a river, above or below a polluting source. Well,
sure. Mm-hmm. Right. So, one of the nice things, if there is a positive side to any of this, is one of the nice things is that a lot of these cases of pollution help to provide us with sort of a natural or an unnatural unintentional experiment, and so we can, as you say, we have nice little elegant sets of comparisons where we can look, say, upstream and downstream of a potential of a source of contamination, such as a sewage treatment plant or a paper and pulp mill or something like that, and have pretty good reason to believe that the fish upstream are going to be similar to the fish downstream in all the respects except for the fact that they've been exposed to these chemicals. And so any changes that we see as a result, we're pretty sure that we can attribute to exposure to the chemicals.
You've talked about changes. One of the reasons we're calling this gender benders is because actually there are some changes in the apparent gender of an animal, although it's not really physical per se. Talk about some of the runoff studies that you've encountered that affect gender.
So there are a fair number of studies that have shown, and actually there are some that actually do seem to affect the physical nature. There's certainly the genes of the animals haven't been affected, but in terms of what sort of sex organs they show, in some cases that has been affected. So there's been a number of studies looking at, as we just said, fish downstream from sewage treatment plants becoming males, becoming increasingly female-like in terms of what their sex organs are like and what their hormone levels are like, and then ultimately in terms of what their behavior is like. And cases of the flip side of this, of animals, of females becoming hyper-masculinized, so again their sex organs and their behavior becoming increasingly like males. A really prominent example of this is in Florida in a really contaminated lake, called Lake Apopka, where alligators have become, had their genders bended considerably by exposure to these kinds of chemicals.
Well, now we'll talk about the predictive nature of this, which I think is cutting edge, because traditionally, in terms of trying to determine the status of an environment and whether or not it's been polluted, that takes tremendous amounts of research. It's oftentimes you have to have some sort of baseline data, you know,
sure,
how have things been, and then chemical analysis and a lot of laboratory work. And what you're suggesting, which I think is cutting edge, is the fact that by learning the changes that happen from certain chemical pollutants in toxic chemicals in our system, we may be very easily, it's like a flag that if we're sensitive to that, we may
right.
notice, and it may give us a reason to look further.
Right. Certainly our hope is not to try to replace, you know, traditional toxicology studies, but as you say, those kinds of things are typically very, you know, labor intensive and time intensive and expensive. And what we'd like to see happen is we'd like to see more people, both at the amateur and the professional level, out there sort of keeping tabs on what animals are doing and what's normal and what's not normal, and by that being able to really identify either particular areas, geographic areas of concern, or populations that might someday go experience some decline or crash because they're beginning to show the early stages of chemical contamination. And so certainly we are hoping to develop some of these behavioral techniques to sort of help, as you say, be this early warning system.
Well, that, of course, that's where listeners to the Wild Side News could play such an important role, because these are people who get out into the wild. They oftentimes are birders, or they watch animals because they're in that environment. What sort of unusual behaviors might they be looking for that might be important for people to find out about?
Right. As you mentioned, people who watch birds are probably the best possible resource out there in terms of people power, because people who are avid bird watchers are typically very knowledgeable about the birds. They know not only which species are which, but they know which sex is which, and they know old birds from young birds, and they're able to see these kinds of things. And they also know a fair amount about bird behavior. In fact, they often know a lot more than people who have PhDs and study this kind of stuff. And so what I think is important is that they take their years of experience watching birds, and if they see things that are sort of atypical, that they take notes on them, or they report them to wildlife officials, or they try to find someone at a local college or university who might be working on that kind of organism. So one example is one of the classic cases where sort of casual observation picked out a serious problem was cases in California in the 70s where these species of gulls were beginning to pair up in female-female pairs rather than in the normal female-male pairs. And it didn't take a very experienced bird watcher to be able to see that those weren't normal bird pairings. And as it turns out, following some more follow-up work, that turns out that the males in the population had all been seriously feminized by exposure to DDT, and so there was not a lot of really physically competent males in the population, and so females were having trouble finding mates. And so that's the kind of thing where, again, amateur watchers could be quite useful at trying to pick out those kinds of unusual occurrences.
You're trying to actually forge sort of a new alliance between classic toxicologists and ethologists to start really putting this information together. And as you do, I suppose a sort of a whole new arena of science may be developing here. What is the prospect of that, and how might people then, as this develops, keep informed and stay in touch and contact people who matter?
Sure. Well, I can't take any credit for being the first to try to forge these two disciplines together, but because there has been a movement in the past 5 or 10 years, some people have actually given it a name, which is called ethotoxicology, combining the term ethology with toxicology. And but I certainly hope that this is sort of a push in that direction. I think that there are a small minority of people who study animal behavior who know a little bit about toxicology, and a small minority of toxicologists who know something about animal behavior. And so what we hope in compiling all this evidence is that we can really try to get people from these two normally disparate groups to, you know, get together and exchange data more often.
Dr. Cloudfelter, I want to thank you for giving us your thoughts, and we'll track on this into the future. Thank you so much.
Sure, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. You know, it's north to Alaska, to Sitka, our park of the week. When we return here on the Wild Side News.